From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. On today's show, a recipe for lower gas prices, water, sugar, and a little bit of yeast. We'll tell you about do-it-yourself ethanol and protecting high school teachers from punishment when their student journalists go too far.
Students believe, and many principals believe, that they can censor material for any reason they want to, and it's much more complicated than that. That's simply not the case.
Also on the Central Coast, a landmark anniversary for Hearst Castle, and remembering the life of Utah Phillips, folk singer, hobo, and working class hero.
I decided I was going to work at the trade, not the entertainment industry. I keep my feet on the ground.
I'm Scott Schaefer, glad you could join us for the California Report. Pain at the pump, that's where we start today. Gas will set you back more than $4 a gallon in most parts of the state these days, and no one expects things are going to get better anytime soon. That's got drivers looking for ways to cut their costs. One possibility is mixing gasoline with ethanol. Amy Standen has the story of one Silicon Valley entrepreneur placing a big bet on that particular biofuel.
You almost need a PhD to keep track of all the new, greener ways you can drive these days. But ethanol is the only alternative fuel that can be mixed in with gasoline in a regular combustion engine car. And now, a California company called eFuel, headed by Silicon Valley investor Tom Quinn, says you can make your own ethanol for as little as $1 a gallon.
What we have here is the microfueler. It has a hose and nozzle, just like you'd find at the gas station. And let me turn it on here. But it just takes
the microfueler runs about $10,000 or less, depending on available rebates. Quinn has his set up in the palm tree-lined driveway of his Los Gatos mansion. It looks kind of like a large washer-dryer with a small LCD control panel and a switch on the front.
It's so easy. It's like I call it third-grade science.
Put in sugar, water, a little bit of yeast, and flip the switch. A couple days later, your ethanol is ready.
Turn on it to pump. There's a pump key there, and you can hear the pump just starting up right now. And all we got to do is take this thing and put it up to the car and fill it up.
There's some debate over what percentage of ethanol a regular car can handle. Quinn says a 65% ethanol gas mix is fine, though California regulators cite a much lower figure. In any case, this is a supplement, not a replacement for gasoline. You'd go to the gas station and get your tank partly filled as usual, and then add your homebrew. To demonstrate, Quinn drags the 50-foot hose over to my car, unscrews the gas lid, and starts pumping.
There you go. If you want, you just put your hand on it, smell it.
Smells like rubbing alcohol.
That's right. It's alcohol, and it just went in your tank.
Unlike this stuff, most mass-market ethanol produced in the U.S. is made from corn. That's controversial because corn takes a lot of energy to grow and process. It also takes that corn out of food production, which can drive up prices of everything from tortillas to soft drinks. But the microfueler uses sugar, which is easier to ferment than corn and is mostly produced overseas. Now, the microfueler requires a lot of it, about 13 pounds of sugar for every gallon of ethanol. So where do you get it?
It's table sugar. You'd find it at Starbucks or your local store. But to buy it in quantities, you want to go to a company called Sysco, S-Y-S-C-O.
I decided to follow Quinn's suggestion.
Hello, this is Matthew.
Eventually, I was referred to a San Francisco-based sugar dealer named Matthew Mosbrook. He was a little bit stumped.
We've never really done home deliveries, but I'd have to get back to you on that. The best way to go about it for home delivery is Costco.
Mosbrook didn't want me to quote exact prices on the air, but he said raw turbinado sugar runs about 85 cents a pound. That would put a gallon of pure ethanol at $11, not including the cost of water, yeast, or electricity, which makes regular gasoline look like a bargain. But Quinn thinks sugar prices are set to come way down. He guesses they'll end up about 2 cents a pound, thanks to a provision under the most recent farm bill. And he says a little detective work can turn up other sources, like waste sugar from soda companies. Even then, how environmentally responsible is this microfueler ethanol? Dan Kamen, an energy expert at the University of California in Berkeley, says, as with most things, the devil is in the details.
If you're sure that your sugar was waste sugar, that would be a good resource to use for making your own ethanol. But if your sugar is coming at the expense of either workers' rights in Brazil or the sugar producer who's producing it sustainably but is also buying new rainforest land and cutting that down, that is a very slippery slope to go down.
Which is why Kamen wonders whether this whole do-it-yourself fuel thing is such a good idea in the first place.
What we need to do is to set standards so that the big industrial producers are producing the most sustainable, the greenest fuels possible. And an effort to get everyone to do it in their own backyard is actually going to make this job much more complicated.
But entrepreneur Tom Quinn disagrees.
If you continue to say, look, I want to get the gas station to do it, you're part of the oil infrastructure. We'll never break it by doing it that way.
Quinn says his company has sold over 1,000 microfuelers so far, and the product isn't even in stores yet. E-Fuel will start delivering its first ethanol machines this fall. For the California Report, I'm Amy Standen.
The First Amendment and California law protect student journalists working at school newspapers from administrators who don't like their stories. But the teachers who advise those students? Not so much. Well, now a bill to extend those protections to high school and college newspaper advisors is making its way through the state legislature. KPCC's Adolfo Guzman Lopez has the story.
Where might you find the next teenage Woodward or Bernstein? Maybe at a workshop during the recent National High School Journalism Convention in Anaheim.
Welcome to the heart of the story.
Alice Guest McKellar and her daughter Amanda McKellar are set to help a few dozen high school students sharpen their reporting skills. But first, a quiz.
Jenny's mother has three daughters. The first one's name is Dime. The second one's name is Nickel. What's the third one's name? Okay, number two. Why can't a man living in Utah be buried in Maryland?
Careful listening, McKellar said, is key to reporting. The answers? The third daughter's name is Jenny. The man is still alive, hardly ready to rest 6 feet under. 11th grader Haley Miller loved the workshop.
Well, I know that for me, I've always sort of had a passion for journalism, and I think that being on a high school newspaper shows you how much people don't care. We have to have a newspaper. If we don't, then people aren't going to know what's going on.
High school journalists like Miller and their advisors also have reason to know their First Amendment rights inside and out.
Students believe, and many principals believe, that they can censor material for any reason they want to, and it's much more complicated than that. That's simply not the case.
Jerry Appel with Indiana's Ball State University Journalism Department said he hears lots of stories at these conventions about administrators who block stories, not because the content is obscene, libelous, or potentially disruptive, but because they disagree with it.
A student columnist wrote a piece urging tolerance for homosexuals. It's not saying that homosexuality is okay. It was just saying, let's be nice to people. The principal did not care for the story that ran, and long story short, the newspaper advisor was fired.
Fired from the position of newspaper advisor and reassigned to another classroom. California law, Appel added, protects student journalists from administrator reprisals, but the law doesn't extend the same protections to the teachers who serve as journalism advisors. Orange County teacher Janet Ewell found that out 6 years ago when her principal praised her skills during her annual evaluation.
And then he said, we've decided that the paper needs to take a new direction and I would not be advising the next year.
In the preceding months, her journalism students had written about dirty bathrooms, bad cafeteria food, and a few apathetic teachers. The day after the evaluation, Ewell broke the news to her class.
The kids cried and I cried, and then two of my little sophomores came up to me and said, we need to go conduct an interview. Can we be excused from class? Very normal sort of thing to happen. And I said, sure. And they bounced in and accosted the principal in the best journalistic fashion and said, are you removing Mrs. Ewell because of our editorials? They caught him off guard, and he said, well, that was part of it, but it wasn't the final straw.
Ewell didn't want to disclose the name of her school. She's worried her principal will penalize her. State Senator Li Lingyi said he's documented similar cases from 8 California school districts. His bill would shield journalism advisors. Student newspapers, he said, are supposed to act as vigilant watchdogs, monitoring everyone whose actions affect life on campus. That's what South Los Angeles teacher Lacey Budisak had in mind a few months ago when she assigned one of her Fremont High School reporters to write about a growing truancy problem on campus.
The article detailed his day. It said what he did, when was the worst time to ditch, when was the best time to ditch. He took pictures of kids ditching, but the conclusion of the article was, while it's easy to ditch, it's boring, so don't do it.
Administrators and campus security guards didn't like the article, she said. But she's not worried because her principal supports the newspaper. And guess what? The ditching rate fell after the story ran. For the California Report, I'm Adolfo Guzman-Lopez in Los Angeles.
This weekend, Hearst San Simeon State Historical Monument, better known as Hearst Castle, celebrates 50 years since it first opened its antique, ornate doors to the general public. Despite being tucked along a fairly isolated stretch of California's coastline, the castle continues to draw huge crowds from inside the state and from well beyond its borders. Reporter Reed Pilafont paid a visit.
It's a sunny morning on a hilltop overlooking California's central coast as 50 tourists step off a bus onto the manicured grounds of one of the state's most popular landmarks.
On behalf of California State Parks, welcome to Hearst Castle. I'm Kathy Shelton. I'll be your guide today for tour number one, the experience tour.
The tour winds its way around the sprawling 165-room estate, built and furnished by newspaper magnate William Randolph Hearst. Hearst had camped on the property as a young man before beginning construction on what he called the ranch in 1919.
The Neptune Pool holds 345,000 gallons of water. This is enough water to float Christopher Columbus's flagship, the Santa Maria. It's 3.5 feet deep.
The Neptune Pool is one of the tour's iconic stops, a massive outdoor swimming pool surrounded by ancient Greek statues where Hearst visitors could relax under platforms supported by marble columns. On a terrace above the pool, tour guide Kathy Shelton explains how Hearst wanted this estate, with its 25,000 pieces of art and antiquities, to endure as a living museum. But after Hearst's death in 1951, it took his family 6 years to find a suitable caretaker.
They kept approaching the state of California, who finally said, okay, we'll take it on a 3-year probationary period. If it doesn't work out, you get your white elephant back.
The state wondered whether visitors would bother to travel 250 miles from either San Francisco or Los Angeles. The answer came quick, says the castle's executive director, Hoyt Fields. He's been here for 38 years.
June the 2nd, 1958, we opened. Gentlemen in suits and hats and women in dresses and gloves bought their tickets. We had capacity for 600. We were sold out immediately. We turned away that many and more. I mean, the first day that we opened, it set the trend that this was something that people wanted to see.
Randy Harris was one of the few people who had seen the estate before it opened to the public, and he still has photos given to him by the castle's famous tenants.
But this one is to Baby Randolph with good wishes from Marion Davis. I'm Baby Randolph.
Harris's parents were housekeepers to Hearst and his longtime mistress Marion Davies, and Harris's family lived on the grounds when he was a young boy. Harris says Hearst was a friendly man who took good care of his employees and their families.
My job would be at about 11 or 11:30 to go wake him up so he could go to his writing lesson with Cipriano Soto. And I was invited to go riding, and I was too bashful. I didn't know how to ride, and I didn't want to learn how to ride because I was too bashful, but I was invited.
It's a much different portrait than the austere, self-indulgent character in Citizen Kane, the legendary film inspired by Hearst, which also caricatured his beloved ranch as the private pleasure ground Xanadu.
Contents of Xanadu's palace. Paintings, pictures, statues, the very stones of many another palace. A collection of everything, so big it can never be cataloged or appraised. Enough for 10 museums, the loot of the world.
And into the theater.
Today, the castle's visitors are almost as varied as its art. One hears a mosaic of languages, Spanish, French, German, Hebrew, along with accents from across the United States. MJ Short and his wife Elena are visiting from South Carolina. Compared to the mansions on the East Coast, Short says,
it's elegant and dramatic, but this is much more warm and friendly and, well, California style.
In its first 50 years, more than 37 million visitors have toured Hearst Castle. But rising gas prices and the passage of time give new reason to wonder whether they'll continue to make this out-of-the-way trek. Executive Director Hoyt Fields.
The people that came at the beginning knew the name Hearst. 1 in 4 Americans read a Hearst publication, a newspaper, magazine, so they knew the name Hearst. They were coming to look at this, this edifice that this man built and furnished.
The challenge for the next 50 years, Field says, is to maintain the castle's relevance as the shadow of William Randolph Hearst recedes further into history. For the California Report, I'm Reed Pilafont in San Simeon.
Hearst Castle will be offering the experience tour for free this Monday, June 2nd, in celebration of the 50th anniversary. To learn about all the tours offered and to get more history on the castle, go to hearstcastle.com. Many California towns have their own way of celebrating the start of summer. And for the Fresno County town of Coalinga, it's a horned toad derby. Now, the first thing you have to know is that horned toads aren't actually toads. They're lizards. And catching enough of them for the derby can be a bit of a challenge. Kathy Seitz and her husband Mark are two experienced lizard hunters who scour the hills just west of town.
We have several decades of horned toad hunting experience under our belts now. My dad used to say it's kind of like fishing. You might go out and catch your limit in 15 minutes, and you might go spend a four-day weekend and not get a bite. And we've done that plenty.
To catch the toads, they have to cover a lot of ground, putting along at 1 or 2 miles an hour in a Jeep. Mark Seitz says you need keen eyesight and agility.
And a lot of times they'll run into ground squirrel holes. The problem with that is sometimes a rattlesnake will actually be inside of a ground squirrel hole, and they'll be waiting for a ground squirrel. So we'll dig them out, you know, sometimes. We can chase them and dig them out.
The horned toads they do round up look a lot alike, so the little critters have to sit still long enough to have a number watercolored onto their backs. Despite their fierce, prehistoric looks, the palm-sized reptiles are not really that tough, says horned toad wrangler Jerry Lander.
And they're real fragile. The little legs, you just barely pull on them or something. You'll break them, you know. Yeah, or their tail will break real easy.
The competition starts with the horned toads corralled in a red bottomless bucket and a ring that looks something like a backyard kiddie pool. The clock starts when the bucket is lifted. People cheer for their favorite lizard and thump the sides of the race board, hoping to coax their pick across the finish line, about a 5-foot sprint.
This is the race for this mean green biking machine.
But privately, longtime Derby MC and local science teacher Glenn Mitchell admits what really makes the lizards go is Coalinga's heat.
The reptiles are cold-blooded, and the speed that they run is directly dependent on the temperature. We've had races that run in the proverbial blink of an eye, 15, 20 seconds, and I've called races that have lasted the better part of a half an hour because the horned toads just have a mind of their own.
So considering the unseasonably cool weather for this week's 72nd annual Derby, the winning lizard had a pretty decent time.
We have a winner. Horned toad number two. Horned toad number two.
The horned toad named Sadie came in at 7 minutes 32 seconds. The winning prize for Sadie and all the other lizard athletes is release back into their native habitat.
All right, on behalf of the Coalinga Chamber of Commerce, thank you all for participating in this year's Horned Toad Derby. Special thanks to all the vendors, all the talent.
To check out pictures of this year's Horned Toad Derby, visit our website, californiareport.org. Finally today, a correction. A couple of weeks ago, in our segment on the statewide reaction to the California Supreme Court decision on same-sex marriages, we misidentified the pastor from the Skyline Church in San Diego. His correct name is Jim Garlow. Our apologies. And that's our show for today. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director this week is Nina Thorson. Seal Muller is the technical producer. We also had engineering from Howard Gelman and Danny Bringer. The online editor is Gabriel Cohen. Our interns are Ali Tabatabai, Harry Gregory, June Stinson, and Leanne Lucetta. She produced our visit to the Horned Toad Derby. Our producer is Victoria Malione. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. Raul Ramirez is the executive producer. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the Wesley Foundation for coverage of immigration issues throughout California, and the California Healthcare Foundation and Cal Hospital Compare, rating hospital quality in California. on the web at calhospitalcompare.org.